It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look into the future of some of Wisconsin's lighthouses, many of which are currently up for auction.
Yesterday, the Seventh Circuit Federal Court of Appeals effectively sent the John Doe investigation back into the state courts with an injunction on a previous federal ruling that had blocked the investigation.
It's the latest in a legal volley over whether the so-called John Doe investigation can carry on. The case centers around the accusation that Governor Walker's past campaigns illegally coordinated with conservative groups on things like fundraising and campaign spending.
Reporter Chuck Kornbach has been following this story. He joins us from our studio in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the basics. What did the appeals court decide yesterday?
Well, as you were sort of saying there, the appellate court, which heard the arguments in this case a few weeks ago in Chicago, I was down there for that, they expressed some dismay, disappointment at the time that this case was before them, and effectively then said yesterday that this case doesn't belong before us, that this is a state of Wisconsin investigation, state of Wisconsin matter, and therefore the federal district judge, Rudolph Randa in Milwaukee, basically was wrong to intercede and issue an injunction, and they have the three-judge panel has sent the case back to the Wisconsin courts.
So you might think, okay, this thing is moving around again, it's back in play, but it's actually not. It's still on hold. Can you tell us about that edge of it?
Kind of an N on the neutral, like the neutral space on your dashboard or your vehicle. So it's the state Supreme Court and appellate courts in Wisconsin are being asked to review a decision by the presiding judge in what's called John Doe 2, Gregory Peterson, who about a year ago stopped subpoenas in the case and said there was not much of a case there. So the things have been on hold, really, in a way, since then. It was later the Club for Growth, the conservative group, allegedly coordinated with Governor Walker, sued in federal court, went after the prosecutors that had been pursuing them. And that's how it got into federal court. As I say, the federal court has basically, it seems, stopped things, although there could be an appeal of yesterday. But things are not moving along at any fast clip in the state courts as far as we know.
Now, the ruling also effectively dismissed a lawsuit against the prosecutors behind us. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying. Back in February, a Club for Growth sued the prosecutors, saying that the free speech rights of Club for Growth and Eric O'Keefe, one of their leaders, had been violated, free speech rights, rights of association, and so on. Judge Randa had said, yeah, I agree with that. But the federal appeals court yesterday said, listen, this is not a matter for the federal courts.
Now, what has been the response so far, both from Governor Walker and from the Democratic Party?
Well, Governor Walker was quizzed about the ruling shortly after it came out yesterday afternoon in Milwaukee and sort of repeatedly said he praised Judge Peterson, the state court presiding judge who had basically halted things, as praised Judge Peterson as being independent from Governor Walker and independent from the governor's friends. And so the governor is basically relying, it sounds like, on Judge Peterson's a hold on things to carry the day, at least for a while.
Now, as far as how this whole thing could proceed, although the injunction is being lifted, as we said, the investigation is on hold, not going anywhere for the time being. But if the Supreme Court were to pick it up, how would that happen?
Well, they would, I guess, want to. They would say there's reason to take this up. But, you know, it's getting into the murky world of politics and law of the Wisconsin court system. State Supreme Court, as of late, has been in Governor Walker's favor on a bunch of rulings, and they could say, well, we don't really want to take up this case right now, maybe later on. Or there could be an effort to bring it up now and talk about it. I would sort of be surprised in the weeks before the November election that this would get a rapid look, the Judge Peterson ruling would get a rapid look by the state Supreme Court or an appellate court, but wouldn't completely rule it out.
But probably you're saying not likely to happen before the election in November.
Tough to predict. I think most people would be surprised if it came up, but again, it cannot be counted out.
Now, part of Judge Randa's earlier ruling, he had said that the documents involved in the John Doe investigation should be destroyed. Where are we with that? Is that still in place?
Well, I think that was stopped. There was a bunch of documents that came out in August, of course, suggesting that Governor Walker was urging, or his campaign staff was urging Governor Walker to tell various groups to send your money to Club for Growth. And there was a lot of money that came in from mining interests in that matter. And Democratic candidate for Governor Mary Burke has said, well, if that wasn't illegal, it ought to be. So there were documents that came out that yesterday. The appellate court said, that's all the documents we're going to release for now. There was an effort by a media group, a Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, who argued, their attorneys argued in Chicago a few weeks ago to release more documents, but the judges yesterday kept under lock and key, or wherever these things are kept these days, in computer files, about, I guess, 8 documents pertaining to the Doe case.
So here we are in the lead up to the midterm election, and that's coming up November 4th. Is this going to make any difference with voters? We've been watching this judicial ping pong going on, but is any of it going to sway people when they go to the polls?
Well, you know, what we know is that Marquette University, and it's one of its polls last week, released last week, actually still showed a majority of people respond said this is just politics and not something huge going on here. In fact, the percentage that said it was just politics had gone up since a poll a few months ago. In other words, all the documents that spilled out in August seemed to have indicated to some people that it was, well, just even more politics. I don't care about this. Now, you know, it's still 37% of those saying that something is going on here, and we don't quite know whether it was Walker's supporters or past supporters saying it's just politics, or if there were some past supporters of his saying, this is kind of serious. So there is still the potential, it's thought, that as Doe story continues, that it wounds him at least a little bit, at least at the state level, and it certainly potentially dims his national picture, although what happens in November with the voting matters more. But, you know, the headline in the New York Times yesterday, or this morning actually, was a court returns graft case to Wisconsin, and there's a picture of Governor Walker being interviewed, I think, in Madison. So when words like graft make the headlines, even though it's an allegation, it does sort of potentially stay worth a candidate, at least if he has national office in mind.
Now, is there any inkling of an appeal to the appeals court ruling from the Club for Growth?
Oh, yeah, it seems that there might be an attempt to get the full Seventh Circuit in Chicago to review what the 3 judges said yesterday. Now, the 3 judges that heard the case, 2 Republican appointees and 1 Democratic appointee. So I'm not sure if the full and en banc, I think they say, the full panel of appellate judges will hear this. That's also, of course, a question in the voter ID case where the ACLU and others want a full hearing at the appellate court. Don't know if either one's going to happen, either in voter ID or here in the Doe case.
So far, no court dates for you to cover yet, sounds like.
Or Sean Johnson or any of our other Gil Halstead or other legion of staff trying to keep up with this case.
All right, Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
There's a lot of things you could do with $50,000. For example, you could maybe buy a lighthouse.
That's right. The federal government is auctioning off lighthouses in Wisconsin and the broader Great Lakes region. So if you've ever dreamed of owning one of what's been romantically called America's castles, well, that time is here.
The Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal Lighthouse was auctioned off earlier this month with a high bid of $48,500. Bob Desch, Executive Director of the Door County Maritime Museum, is here with us now for this week's edition of Curious Wisconsin to talk about that lighthouse and how other lighthouses are being preserved around the Great Lakes. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, first, tell us about that Sturgeon Bay Lighthouse. What does it look like? Give us a mental picture.
Okay, it's actually the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal North Pierhead Light. That's a mouthful, but it is a large red steel structure, with a traditional light tower and lantern on one end, and then really just a big square rectangular metal building is the rest of the structure, and it's on the very end of the seawall. That is on the north side of the entrance to the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal as you come in from Lake Michigan.
And who owns these lighthouses now that we're auctioning them off?
Okay, they're presently were traditionally owned by the Lighthouse Service and then later the United States Coast Guard. And when the Coast Guard then declares a piece of lighthouse property as excess to their needs, then it either goes to the Bureau of Land Management or the General Services Administration, more commonly known as GSA, for disposal.
So tell us about their mission. How crucial were lighthouses like this one to shipping in the Great Lakes?
Oh, at one time they were incredibly important. In the days when the mariner fixed their position on the face of the earth, if you will, if they took a line of bearing from a known object, whether that's a cliff or a lighthouse, they were able to lock in on that object and take a line of position and figure out where they were there in the water. And then they also served, as the pierhead light did, to mark the entrance to a harbor or to mark an obstruction like that seawall. So the mariner, you know, back in the days of sail and even the days of, steam up until we started getting radar and GPS and Loran and some of those other navigational aids, you know, it was the way you got from one place to another safely was to use that lighthouse to know where you were and where the dangers were.
And so presumably since these are being auctioned off, those things you mentioned, GPS and others, have replaced that function. The ships are not relying on these lighthouses now.
That's true. There's still kind of a security blanket, I guess, if you will, and a lot of small boaters probably still use them to kind of generally know where they are when they're piloting in and out of a place. But the days of when a coastwise merchant vessel, you know, traveling up the coast of Lake Michigan would use the lighthouses to know where they were, those days have long passed. Now they glance down at their chart display information system, and they see exactly where their vessel is, you know, based on GPS and the compass and all kinds of other data that's being fit into this, electronic system. So they may look out the window and see the lighthouse and get a little bit of a secure feeling that this thing that they're looking at on the in the wheelhouse is accurate. But the days of relying on the lighthouse to know where they are, they've passed.
So now they're being sold off. What is it like? How do they go through the process of selling a lighthouse?
Well, once the Coast Guard is in the aids of navigation business, and so they maintain a very viable aids of navigation system that contains a whole lot of different things, you know, buoys and range lights and all those kinds of things. And the lighthouses are part of that, obviously. But it's they're not paid to be in the historic preservation business. So from the aids of navigation standpoint, you could do it a lot cheaper with a smaller, more efficient structure. But the light happens to now be in this, this archaic building. So they say, well, we still need the light, but we really don't need the building, and we're not being funded properly to maintain this thing from a historical standpoint. So they declare it excess to their needs. And then it would go either to the Bureau of Land Management or the General Services Administration, depending on, how the property was acquired by the federal government. And then it would go out in the first step under the Lighthouse Preservation Act is that it's offered to other entities of government, either federal government or state and local government or eligible nonprofits. And then that'll be transferred to those entities basically for free. And there's a very involved process. You put together a very comprehensive package of how you're going to maintain the light and what you're going to do with the light. And then the National Park Service, their history people actually review that and make a decision as to where the thing should go. As an example, there are some of these island lighthouses where they are very sensitive to bird patterns, as far as flight patterns and wildlife and all that kind of thing. And some of them have been actually transferred to, the Fish and Wildlife Service. Plum Island here off the coast of Door County is one of those places. or, you know, to a nonprofit who's going to, you know, in the historic preservation business, is going to maintain it. If nobody takes it in that process, then it goes up for sale, basically. It goes to auction, any citizen can put a bid in. They declare a minimum bid, and then usually there's multiple bidders, and someone ends up with the lighthouse for that highest bid.
And, Bob, I've kind of buried the lead here. The thing on everyone's mind, I assume, is could you buy a lighthouse and turn it into your house?
You could. There are a lot of restrictions. It is a historic property, so it's governed by a lot of the rules of the Historic Preservation Act. And as well, it's still continuing, to serve a minimal function as a navigation lane. So it kind of has to be kept the way it looks on the outside. But you could do. You have more liberty with the inside of that, and you deal with the State Historic Preservation Office, and you could turn it into your house. Several lighthouses have been either sold off or transferred to nonprofits, and they now function as bed and breakfasts. There are other ones that function as private residences somewhere.
So $48,500 doesn't seem like a lot for a lighthouse. I know some in the northeastern part of the country, I think Maine and thereabouts, have gone for, you know, numbers like $1 million. Why not this one?
Well, first of all, it's a big steel box. it was never intended to be lived in. The keepers for this particular lighthouse lived in a house on the shore and got out to the lighthouse on an elevated catwalk. And so it was really an equipment building. It had fog signal equipment in it and other equipment necessary for the light itself. So, it's at a lower price because it never really was a house, right? So if you're going to use it for a house or you're going to use it as a bed and breakfast, those kinds of things, it's got a long way to go to get to that place. The other one is it's on an end of a seawall, and the seawall that it is on is detached from the larger seawall that runs out there. So really it can only be accessed by this elevated causeway. There is no sewer. There is no water. The electrical power that goes out to the light is a cable that's maintained by the Coast Guard. So if you wanted more power out there for other uses, you would have to be able to arrange for that as well. So, you know, the price of the property is lower because of its location. The other thing is it sits on top of a seawall that will continue to be owned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So whoever has purchased the lighthouse will enter into a separate lease agreement with the Corps for the piece of concrete that is right beneath the light. So so those ones that are selling for pretty big bucks are usually on an island where you are acquiring the property that is around the lighthouse as well. And at one time or another, a lighthouse keeper and his family, her family lived out there. And so, you know, it's more of a house type location, easier to get to by boat and that kind of thing.
So it's a rustic fixer upper, as the real estate agents might say. Do we know what the owner's going to do with it?
We don't know yet. At this point, the General Services Administration typically does not release the name of the buyer. Having seen some of these other properties and other locations around the Great Lakes, eventually the owner sort of reveals themselves, right? The public interest, they will reveal who they are and what their intentions are to do with the light. So I don't know who it is at this point, as a maritime history guy, glad to see going to someone so that someone's going to start taking care of it, because the requirement is you gotta maintain this thing. So that's a good thing. I'll be interested to see what they decide to do with the interior of the light.
Now, you at the Maritime Museum didn't get this lighthouse, but you have another one, I understand.
Correct. Yeah, we've had a relationship with Kena Island Lighthouse, which is up near Bailey's Harbor, for quite some time. The Maritime Museum entered into a lease for that property back in the mid '70s, and when it became available through this process, we worked with the County of Door and particular county parks for the county to actually acquire that piece of property, and we manage it on behalf of the county, and we're in the midst of a literally multi-million dollar restoration project. The first couple of projects were to acquire some property so we could put a parking lot. So you can imagine acquiring waterfront property near the lighthouse for a parking lot. That was a pretty expensive endeavor all by itself. And then to upgrade the sanitary facilities from porta potties to at least a modern, if there is such a thing, pit toilet. And now we're in the midst of a $1 million plus restoration of the exterior of the lighthouse, with plans to do the interior lighthouse as we can acquire the funds.
And are we going to be able to take a tour of that lighthouse when all this is done?
Oh, absolutely. Kena Island is open for tours right now. Even during this restoration process, we've kept the lighthouse open, and occasionally we have to close the light tower itself, which is unique at Kena Island. You can actually climb the tower in, you know, into the light tower. Occasionally during this restoration project, we've had to close it for a day or two. But other than that, you know, we've been able to keep it open, and we kind of look at it and say, this is a pretty unique opportunity to go see an added exhibit, if you will, as the restoration work goes on. And we actually looked at the big red lighthouse at the end of the pier, the Sturgeon Bay Canal pierhead light, and for us, with all that we're doing with Kena Island, it was just a bridge too far for us trying to take on another very expensive restoration project.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us and painting us a picture of our lighthouses.
Oh, thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Bob Desch. He's executive director of the Door County Maritime Museum, about the sale of lighthouses in Wisconsin and around the Great Lakes region by the federal government. By the way, next week on Curious Wisconsin, we will meet a cult hero from the state, Wisconsin filmmaker Mark Borchardt.
And Rob, I want to ask you before we go on, would you want to live in a lighthouse?
If you ask, like, teenage Rob, that would sound really cool. You could do a lot of cool stuff with a lighthouse. Grown-up Rob would think about all the maintenance that it would involve and the wind
exactly.
And how much you'd have to insulate. So I think maybe not. Sorry.
All right. Yeah, I think I'm with you. It sounds kind of cool, though.
A new project out of central Wisconsin looks to capture the voices of a group of people that we don't always hear from, our state's rural residents.
Through a series of oral interviews, the People of Rural Wisconsin Project looks to share the stories of rural residents throughout the state. It also hopes to answer some pretty big questions about the relationship between place and identity and why that matters in today's globalized world.
Joining us now is Matt Groshek. He's senior lecturer of graphic design at UW-Stevens Point, a faculty fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, and he's the project director for People of Rural Wisconsin. He joins us now from our studio in Wausau. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Veronica and Rob. Thank you for having me.
So we mentioned it a bit there in the intro, but in your words, what is the People of Rural Wisconsin project all about?
Right now and in the past, recent past, it's been about collecting oral histories from people that have lived in rural places or live in rural places currently in Wisconsin. That's the short version. I think it's also looking to really listen to people's stories and histories so we can understand better what's going on in those places.
Let's elaborate a little bit more on that. Why do you think it's so important that these stories get told, get shared?
I think that in our culture in particular and in other places, we sort of discount rural. It's often defined as what isn't urban. And really, Wisconsin, a large part of it is a rural place. I think that we need to pay attention again to the continuum between what's rural and urban as a way to understand all those places. And those stories help us shape an understanding of that.
Now, as you're talking to people and collecting these interviews, what kind of questions are you asking?
Questions really range from, what they think rural is, how they came to live in a place, what their work is in those places, what they believe their life values are in those places. Their relationships with the land, I think, enter into this. In the end, a lot of questions have to do with identity and place. I mean, something that you've already identified.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of different people that you've talked to so far, the age range and, the different professions? Who are they?
I mean, that's been pretty broad in some ways. It's across the state geographically. When the project began, Ed Janis, who was a public historian, initiated this project. He was very much interested in people who had been in farming, dairy farmers, and especially an aging population. So a lot of the stories come from people that are older, that live in rural places or have lived there. And some of them are farming. Some of those people are working in small towns in different sorts of jobs. It really depends on, what was available and what contacts were had early on. So we do want to change some of that. I think right now we're looking to expand the project, and that's kind of where the project's going. So we look for more.
And when you approach someone to do this, what's been the general response? Is it, oh my gosh, yes, I'd love to tell my story, or wait, what? And it takes some trust building to get them going?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think people are eager to tell their stories, and I think people who live in rural places in particular may feel a bit disenfranchised by not having their stories heard. So it really depends on the person. Some people are very eager to talk. They're great at telling stories. You know, they want to do this. Other people are a little reluctant. I know I have neighbors that I've been asking to participate in the project, and they're like, well, you know, I'm not really sure I want to talk about this, or I'm not really sure I have a sense of what that is. And I always ask them as a question to start that potential conversation is, what do you think rural is? How do you identify yourself as a rural person? And inevitably, there's a moment of hesitation there where they try to frame that in their mind or bring to mind what things they value in a rural place that help shape that identity.
Well, let's listen to some of these stories. You talked to one farmer named George who knew early on that he wanted to be a farmer. Let's take a listen.
When I got out of grade school, I just wanted to go into farming. I didn't want to go to school anymore. So in high school, I was old enough, and there wasn't a law then that you had to go to high school, so I stayed home. I wanted to take up some kind of forestry conservation. Then I had to make the decision. Dad would be alone on the farm. He couldn't do it anymore. He was getting old. So what do I do? Stay home and help Dad, or do I go off to college?
So you spent your life as a farmer happily?
I don't know where the happiness comes in it.
Huh. What do you make of that one? He wanted to be a farmer early on, but he's not sure about the happiness. It's interesting.
It is. I think that, again, that person's life is as complicated as anyone's. I mean, we all struggle with this. What do we do? How do we make choices? What sort of choices do we make that impact our family or ourselves? You know, what do we give up to have something else? What gives us joy or pleasure? What's hard? You know, what's a struggle? Those things are questions that everyone has. This idea of happiness, it's elusive. You ask anyone this question, no matter where they live, and they're going to have a response that may be similar. How do we define happiness? What makes us satisfied? You know, how do we live a full and rich life in place?
Happiness is also kind of a word that's more in vogue now, I think, when you're assessing life quality than it used to be. It used to be you lived a decent life, a moral life, a good life, but it wasn't always about happiness.
Right. I mean, I think that's true. And again, I think that's another reason to capture these stories. How has that changing sort of value landscape or moral landscape even, you know, what does that mean? How has that been shaped in a prior time? How is it being shaped now? I know that I'm working with young people all the time every day. And when I talk to them about what matters to them or what has meaning to them, that's shifting all the time.
Well, staying with George's story, he, I guess, faced some difficulties in school. He came from a bohemian background. His teacher wanted to Americanize him more. Here's another excerpt from that interview.
She would come by my desk. Well, she'd walk around the room, you know, and when she'd come to my desk, she would pound on that desk. What's the matter, kid? Ain't you got no brung up? This is my English teacher. And I'd look, oh, my gosh, can I crawl under the desk? And the other kids in the room would be going,
Well, that's probably a common story for immigrants, urban and rural, over the years from a lot of ethnic backgrounds. Have you heard other stories like that in this project?
Yeah, I think there's always something, especially from the older rural residents, that is connected to a sort of transition into a different kind of place. You know, and often that transitions between rural and urban or a place that's not rural, often when they attended school or they were involved in some sort of labor that took them to a different place than maybe often the farm, sometimes just rural. So that shifting, that sort of story is often retold. I think the other thing is even in younger people, I know there is a sort of disenfranchisement of rural and a discounting. When I was working in Indiana and teaching there, I would ask students, you know, where are you from? What's your story? And often with some again, trepidation and shame even. They'd say, I'm from a rural place. You know, my family grows peanuts or soybeans or whatever. And so, again, I think often the attitude is by people that may be very proud to have grown up and lived in a rural place when they reach a point where they're encountering a different sort of population of people with a different background, they have to rethink how that's viewed.
And I want to hear a little more from this project. Now, one of the other people you talked to spoke of land conservation as not just a way of life, but something that should be revered, respected, and passed on. Here's a clip from that.
It was a given that you were, you know, God had provided you with this land, and it was your obligation to take care of it. You would learn it from the pulpit. You would learn it from your ancestors, so to speak. They would sort of pass it along, that this was a given, that this was something that you would continue.
And Matt, that idea of the land, how did that evolve as you talked to more people?
Well, I think that, again, there was a particular time in our more recent history where the idea of land use, and in particular in relation to agricultural use, was pretty well grounded as an identity in rural Wisconsin. And I think now, you know, and I think when I talk to people that are younger, they recognize the contested landscape of the rural landscape. And if you listen to the news or attend to politics at all, you see that those contested territories impact rural people probably most significantly. So there's a shift now where people are trying to understand, you know, what does it mean to have a job in a rural place? How is that tied into resources in a landscape that I live in? How do I preserve that landscape or not to maintain its rural character? Again, what do I value? How do I identify with this place? How do I identify as a rural person? So, again, that's changing all the time. And there's 68 interviews. I haven't listened to all of them. Mm. Certainly, there's a lot more in the archive that we've generated to date to certainly mine and look for some of those questions to be answered.
We're talking with Matt Groshek of the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, and we'd like to hear from you, too.
How do you think the place you live in shapes your identity? Did you grow up in a rural area or an urban area? And do you think rural and urban areas have more in common than we might think? Or maybe, as Matt was saying, this idea sometimes that the rural gets passed over, even in Wisconsin, where we have a lot of rural area in the state. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, which looks to capture the stories, the voices of the state's rural residents, and look at some pretty deep questions about place and who we are. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you live in rural Wisconsin, why do you live there? Is that where you grew up and you stayed, or did you have a vision of a place different than where you grew up? What is it about the rural landscape, living in a rural setting, that appeals to you? Is there a story you'd like to share, and how do you see the relationship between where we live and who we are as people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Matt, we're talking here about rural Wisconsin. What is your connection with the rural in the state?
So I am a rural resident now. I grew up in central Wisconsin in a place called Rudolph, and I actually live there again. So I ended up leaving the area, lived in urban places, Milwaukee, Chicago, Indianapolis, and now I've actually come back to the same property that I grew up on. So I'm, again, a rural resident.
Oh, what is that like coming back again?
So it's funny because people ask this question often, and they ask me about being nostalgic and sort of embracing or engaging that nostalgia. And it's really about coming around again to something that's very different. I mean, I'm a very different person. My life is very different than when I left here. The place is very different. The world is a different place. So it's very exciting to have some connections that persist, especially in the landscape. And there's certain attributes of that landscape that I absolutely love. So it's, for me, it's been really terrific to come back and to have a life that's very different than an urban life and still have some things that are connected to an urban life. So it's been great for me.
Let's check out another one of the interviews that your project has collected. For a woman named Margaret, nature makes her feel like royalty. Here's a little of what she had to say.
We went out into nature, and that was always our delight. I remember Eddie asked me if I wanted to learn how to handle horses, and he let me cut a field of hay, not a whole field, but at least he set me on this thing, and I thought, this is absolutely divine, the fragrance of the hay and the blue sky with a few clouds up above, and here I am like a princess.
Wow. So just rapturous about having the opportunity to get up, lead the horses and work a field and make her feel like royalty, though this is something that royalty typically probably wouldn't do. Do you get that rapture from a lot of the people talking about the landscape?
Yeah, I think that people communicate that pretty well. Often it's a bit subtle. But, you know, other times there's certainly an exuberance about that. I think people describe a kind of rush in experiencing things that are larger than themselves. They're not human. It reminds them of maybe a context that they don't dominate, that something else dominates. And I think people have a rich appreciation for that live in rural places. Often that's a big part of the interview.
Do you think that that is a surprise maybe for people who themselves don't live in rural areas, that there is such passion to the place where these people live? It's not an incidental choice. It's not a failure. It's not somewhere they just landed. It's intention, and it's also joy, like we heard.
Yeah, I think people in urban places, if they've never lived in a rural place, or if a rural place is only that space you drive through as fast as you can to get to an urban place, you know, they may struggle with understanding what that is. And the thing that also comes through the interviews, I think, is that's not always an incredibly beautiful, pleasurable experience, that part of the experience of rural may be that it's dirty, you know, it may offer a struggle, it may challenge someone physically or mentally or emotionally in a way that, and I'm not saying urban places don't do this, but it's very different at times than what those challenges are in an urban place. And really this is about people who come from different tribes sort of trying to share stories. And again, it's the value of the project. We get to hear that voice, maybe understand it, find a resonance that is not us in those other things, and realize this person probably goes through similar things that I go through. Maybe the scale is different. Maybe the thing that drives that response is different, but it's existing in the same sort of manner. So
we'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Brian with us in Cumberland. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Brian?
I do agree, just like the gentleman was talking. I did grow up in a rural area and then never actually left and actually live on the farm that I grew up on. Me and my wife feel, and our kids now are growing in their 22 and 24, that their lives have been very well grounded with the rural community and being on a farm, that when things come up in life and how things don't always go well, or, you know, when you grow cattle and stuff, sometimes cattle do not make it. And the kids are very well grounded in life, I think,
Brian,
growing up in a rural area.
Brian, thank you so much for calling. So, Matt, this idea of this is a great place to raise kids, it really connects them with the planet in a way and with reality. Do you hear that a lot?
Yes, I think that comes through often. I think people, and again, this is sometimes about the hardships that you encounter if you live a rural life. And it may be that you're not a farmer, but you're going to see things die. You're going to see things suffer. You're going to see things fail that might be more immediate in their impact in relation to your life in particular. I think, again, urban places have some of the same conditions, but there's often a buffer there. So yes, I think one of the things we're hearing from people is that, you know, raising a family in those particular places has been important, especially. And again, I'm informally asking people some of these questions before I would do an interview with them, and it comes up often.
We're going to hear from another one of your voices now. This is Loretta, a 92-year-old Wisconsin woman who's known to her friends as Dimp.
I don't like the city at all. I always said that I don't want to live in the city at all. My sister, she's dead now, but she lived in Richland Center. And I said, I used to go down there and visit her, and I thought, how in the world can she stand living in town? One time my husband and I took a trip to Canada, and we got up there and everybody talked French. We decided to come back home.
That's awesome. She's got such joie de vivre, and she expresses herself pretty well. What was she like?
And again, I did not meet Dimp. My experience of her is through that interview. So I can't speak to that personally. But when I hear this, I hear, again, someone who in some ways I think has made up her mind about where she wants to be and the people she wants to be around. In some ways, it might suggest a kind of narrow viewpoint. But again, I think that's common to everyone. You decide, you know, what tribe you want to be around, and where that tribe lives might drive that very much. So I think there's a delightfulness in how she puts that desire to live in a place. This other notion about, I could never live in a city, you hear, again, it's one of the things we hear. I would never want to live there. I've never have decided to move to a city. And again, I think there's another place where, do we really represent the urban very well to people that live in rural places? Because there's a richness in that, in rural places and urban places, that, you know, can be found if you have to look for it or if you find yourself in those places. So,
you know, we hear in Wisconsin of a divide. Sometimes it's expressed as Madison and everything else, or Madison, Milwaukee, and Green Bay, and the small towns and rural areas. Is part of this project, you know, trying to address that, to understand each other's viewpoints and cultures, and, hey, maybe we got more in common than we might think?
Yeah, I think when I think of this project and I think of this idea of a polarity between urban and rural, I really think there's a continuum that ranges from, you know, a kind of sense of wildness to rural, semi-rural, suburban, urban, you know, post urban, if you will. There's really a range of experiences that people have. They're connected to place very often, and identities. But really, across that continuum, you have relationships that go back and forth all the time. In fact, some of the research recently by some groups investigating rural conditions have found that a lot of people, 100 days out of their year, they're working in an urban place and they live in a rural, you know, site. Or what they're doing is they're living in a rural place and they're commuting to an urban space. And so, and the other thing is, we can't exist in isolation from any of those things. There's a mosaic of place and life opportunities across the state. Those things are all connected. In a way that's amazing. And I think we forget those connections, again, because we want to preserve some identity. So I think the project offers, again, a sort of maybe a fuzziness about, you know, what is it? What do these things mean? And where are they similar? And also, how do we depend on each other? This is about interdependence. And we have it all the time. We can't exist in isolation. I think especially now we have connections to the whole world. How do you frame your personal identity, your sense of place, with something that might also include an identity that's a world identity? I mean, this is the question. These are the questions. They're interesting and exciting, especially in the 21st century.
Matt, thanks so much for sharing these stories with us, and we'll probably check in with you as you take it forward.
Okay. Thank you very much, Veronica and Rob. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the project.
That's Matt Groshek. He's the project director for People of Rural Wisconsin. Well, I, you know, grew up dirt road. We occasionally got mudded out, cows across the street, cornfield behind us. Now I'm in a mid-sized city, and I don't know, I'm kind of split sometimes. Like, I see real advantages to the way I grew up. Do you ever think, Veronica, of that would be better to raise kids where they can run wild and free?
I miss some of my times in Campbellsport, Wisconsin,
yeah,
actually,
right.
Which one year was left off the map. I guess
right,
that's
yeah.
How insignificant cartographers thought it was. I'm sure it was an oversight. But it was a beautiful place, and I do miss that and the quiet and the peace of it sometimes.
All right. Well, great conversation. Hey, keep sharing your thoughts and stories over at the Central Time Facebook page.